I am Nancy Miller. It turns out, have been talking about 1915C waiver services since 1990 in New York City, for those of you who remember going to New York City. Interestingly enough, at the time, community-based care services and the Medicaid program are something on the order of 2 to 3% of the Medicaid long-term program. So there's been a lot that's really happened here. So I would like to acknowledge that this was funded in part by a larger grant that's with the University of California, San Francisco, with the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research, and actually the initial database construction was also facilitated by a grant from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, because I did some initial work analyzing the relationship between investments in HBS spending and nursing home rates of use for CMS. Many of you know that this is the 20th year anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We actually co-chaired a session with the disability section on the ADA and kind of, where we've come from and where we need to go. I think it's a particularly fitting time to look at the extent to which states have really reconfigured their long-term care systems to provide access to home and community-based care services. Today, and it's been this way since at least 2000, all states provide home and community-based care services to older adults and working-age adults. $2,007, if you average that spending across all the states, it would be just a little over 27% of Medicaid dollars for older and working-age adults went into the community. But there, as there has always been, in this field, substantial variation, so that you can see in 2007, New Mexico put almost two-thirds of its dollars into the community for this target group, whereas in Tennessee, only 1.3% of all long-term care dollars were expended in the community. So that's substantial variation, and it's actually grown over time. I did some calculations, and kind of the cost differences between kind of the lowest and the highest, if you average the lowest five and the top five, and you looked at those in 2000 and 2000, kind of those disparities between your lowest five and your highest five have actually grown over time. So we're seeing this variation not reduce, but actually increase over time. I won't go through this because it was presented quite well previously, that there is a concern that expansion will basically increase demand and lead to increased long-term care expenditures. That's obviously been tracked for many years. It's been analyzed largely at the individual level, and the evidence on the relationship is mixed, although we've had some very encouraging findings presented here. More recently, Stephen K. Mitchell-Plant and Charlene Harrington at the University of California, San Francisco, descriptively analyzed this issue, looking at the extent to which states' investments in community-based care were related to total long-term care expenditures. And they essentially found that the spending growth varied by the level of HCBS investment. So what we're talking about there is, of all your total long-term care dollars, what share of those dollars go into the community and what share go into an institution. They found differences comparing older and working age adults relative to individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, the two primary target groups there. But they found that in states that had what they considered to be established home and community-based care systems, that the total Medicaid long-term care dollars declined over the study period of 1995 to 2005. I'm extending that using a state-level policy framework brought to us by Ed Miller. Ed Miller is not related to me. Ed Miller is not related to Susan Miller, but he does work and is a colleague with Susan at Brown University. So this is basically a state-level model of policy innovation, and I'm employing both descriptive and multivariate analysis here. I use state-level data here. I use state-level data for all the states with the exception of Arizona. I always exclude Arizona because Arizona has always provided its long-term care services under a demonstration waiver. Have lots of different data sources here, including data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, a lot of state-level data from the Census Bureau and the American Community Survey. I turn to CDC's Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey for some state-level estimates of disability, some bed supply measures from CMS, a lot of this from CMS, and the last measure is a measure of the National Governors from the National Governors Association related to the party affiliation of the governor. The primary dependent variable that I was interested in, again, was annual total long-term care expenditures. So I was including nursing facility expenditures, home health expenditures, personal care expenditures, which is an optional state program, and 1915C waiver expenditures, those targeting older adults, working age adults, both, as well as individuals with HIV/AIDS and individuals with traumatic brain injury. The independent variables really follow Ed Miller's model. The independent variable that I was primarily interested in, again, was of all long-term care dollars provided to long-term care, what share go into the community. Ed Miller's model basically looks at factors that are internal to the state. Those are sociodemographic, economic, and programmatic factors, and you can see what I've measured there. He also looks at long-term care supply, and I looked at, in particular, nursing facility beds per capita and home health agencies per capita. I included one political measure, which is the party affiliation of the governor, and the model also looks at influences external to the state, and those are primarily federal-level influences, although in this literature, a lot of states kind of look to other states around them, so there's can often be a state kind of surrounding state effect also. My analytic approach was I basically descriptively examined long-term care expenditures, nursing facility expenditures, and HCBS expenditures, and looked at changes over time. And I should note that these are all per capita numbers, so all the state-level numbers are adjusted by state-level population. And then I used multivariate fixed effects models to examine the relation between the share of dollars supporting HCBS and long-term care expenditures, controlling for these other internal and external state factors. All the dollars are 2007 dollars using the consumer price index, and all the supply measures and home health user measures are also adjusted by state population. So what did I find? First of all, kind of descriptively, there were essentially kind of four different patterns across the states, and I want to walk through those. What I found was that over this 2000 to 2007 period in 14 states, there was actually a decline in total long-term care expenditures. The decline averaged almost 10%. All of those states saw a decline in their nursing facility expenditures, which was just under 20%. All had increases in HBS per capita expenditures, and those averaged just a little under 80%. Then another set of states, 12 being exact, had long-term care expenditure increases of, on average, just under 17%. In those states, there was a nursing facility expenditure decline, but you can see the decline of not quite 10% is roughly half the decline. So they had a decline in nursing facility expenditures, but not nearly the extent of the decline in the states who brought down their total expenditures. And they also had higher, greater increases in their HCBS per capita expenditures. Then there were 21 states where they had long-term care expenditures increases averaging almost 33%. Those there were nursing facility expenditure increases as well as HCBS expenditure increases. And then finally, Mississippi and Kentucky had increases in both total long-term care expenditures, nursing facility expenditures, but actually had declining per capita community-based expenditures. So, looking at the variable of interest, which is the share variable, we actually saw across the study period that 44 states actually increased the share of dollars going into the community. However, there were decreases in Arkansas, Kentucky, and Mississippi over this period, and Pennsylvania and South Carolina were essentially unchanged over this period. In multivariate analysis, I found that the share devoted to community-based care was associated with lower long-term care expenditures over the study period in both unadjusted and adjusted models. For those of you tracking the election results, we'll see that Democrat governors were associated with lower expenditures over this study period. Not surprisingly, nursing facility bed supply and housing affordability, which I should have touched on. I have a measure that's not been used a lot, which basically comes from the American Community Survey. That's an estimate at a state level of the share of housing in a state that is deemed unaffordable following a HUD definition. And the HUD definition is when you spend roughly 33% of your total monthly income toward housing expenses that's deemed unaffordable. So in states where where housing was more unaffordable, we saw higher total long-term care expenditures, likely related to higher nursing facility use. And then the share in the state coming from the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, the share reporting a disability approached significance and was associated with higher total long-term care expenditures. So, discussion. Almost all states expanded access to community-based care, but again, we see this tremendous variability over the study period that's actually increased over the study period. A couple things happened over this period where, when I've written about this before, when we've tracked it, for many years, states really used the 1915C waiver programs to expand access to community-based care. More recently, a number of states have turned to the personal care, the optional benefit. Over this study period, five states started a personal care optional benefit, and those that had a personal care optional benefit increased the use of that. And that's related, when I presented some related findings to CMS, this is actually related to some requirements from the Ticket to Work and Work Incentives Improvement Act, but that basically created the Medicaid Infrastructure Grant Program. And it's always had as part of that legislation that if you receive funding for Medicaid infrastructure activities, you were supposed to provide personal care at a level that would let a person be employed in your state. So for people who are working age and could be employed, you had to provide it. CMS never actually implemented, and then really kind of followed through in requiring that until recently. And so I think roughly 2 years ago, they made it a requirement that states, if they were going to receive their MIG grants, actually had to provide personal assistance services at this level. And you've seen a lot of states really respond by increasing the availability. Looking forward, we do have the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which brings us a new optional Medicaid community for first choice benefit, and continuing increased flexibility to provide waiver services as a state plan. And we'll see with budgets and things how those carry out. And kind of the second big story here is that I may have demonstrated that one can expand access to community-based care services while reducing total long-term care expenditures. However, moderating institutional supply is really critical to that, and I've given you some figures. All states over this period, with the exception of Alabama and Ohio, decreased their nursing facility bed supply. But the decrease was highest in the states that brought their total long-term care expenditures down. A little lower for those who had only NIF expenditure declines, a little lower still for those who saw increases in total NIF and HCBS expenditures, and the lowest, so the reduction of little over 5% in Kentucky and Mississippi, where you saw HCBS expenditures actually decline instead of increase. Another way to look at that, I looked at the five states with the highest relative investment. So those were at the time Alaska, California, New Mexico, Oregon, and Washington. I did their average of per capita bed supply. Their average was 2.98 beds. If you look at NIF beds in the states with the lowest investment, Mississippi, North Dakota, Tennessee, South Dakota, and Utah, you see that they average 6.88, so roughly twice as many nursing facility beds in those states. So. So I think addressing institutional supply is critical. The federal government has actually asked states to explicitly start recognizing this issue. It was built into the grant applications for the Money Follows the Person demonstration, which is a demonstration to find people in nursing homes who've been there for at least 180 days, see if they'd like to try to return to the community and assist them in coming out. States had to, as part of those grant applications, have a mechanism to address their institutional supply. And more recently, under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, there's a rebalancing demonstration, and that's focused on, it's intended to be focused, although they're still working out the details of that, focusing on those states that have relatively low investments in community-based care and providing them incentives primarily through a higher federal matching rate to try to focus on reducing supply to rebalance their long-term care systems. Affordable housing appears to be essential. Housing has been a real issue for people trying to bring people out of nursing homes, and Money Follows the Person. And these findings suggest also that housing has a relationship to long-term care expenditures, probably largely through its relationship between nursing home use. And then the last piece I'd note is that there's appears to be an important role for the governors. I've suggested one place that one could address that. The National Governors Association has best practices, and they also have chairs initiatives. So each year when there's a new chair of the National Governors Association, they have an initiative going back to, it was either 1993 or 1994. Dick Kempthorne, who at the time was the governor, I believe, of it's either Idaho or North, I think a western state, and I want to say, now that I've brought that up, it was Idaho or North Dakota. But anyway, he really focused on this issue around expanding access to community. His initiative was focused on long-term care. And what he did was he came up with 20 things that a state could do on their own without the assistance of anyone else to address long-term care. So I'm just suggesting that this chairs initiative would be another opportunity for the governors in their role as it relates to the Medicaid program at a state level to address this issue. So that's it. Thank you very much.
Well, first, let's give a round of applause to our four speakers. Four very excellent and four very different presentations. We have plenty of time for some questions. What I'd like to do is ask the presenters to come up here. We have four. Michael, in the back.
On the last presentation, I was just wondering, these were all licensed facilities, or what all did you love that?
Nancy?
Yeah, the nursing facility bed supply measure is a measure that I take from CMS. So it comes out of the nursing home data compendium, and they collect their data from the nursing facilities that are in Oscar. So they would be any facility that's certified for the Medicare program or Medicaid program.
And did you notice any differences between, I mean, there's a much higher cost of serving people with serious mental illness in the community compared to an older adult, generally. So these are all lumped together. Did you have units together with disaggregating them?
No, I didn't focus specifically on how these savings might vary by the type of disability. I just basically grouped everyone together that was a working age or an older person with a disability. But clearly there have been, because of some other things that I've written and other people have talked about, particularly the mental health piece of this, in a kind of an entirely separate analysis, there are a lot of issues going on with mental health use and mental health use increasing in nursing homes for both kind of working age and older adults, which is really kind of a very important, but kind of separate from what I've looked at. I will note, because I'm here representing CMS and we talk about this all the time, only three states out of all the states who have Money Follows a Person demonstration dollars have targeted people with serious mental illness in a nursing home. And in the first year's study of implementation of Money Follows a Person, one person with a serious mental illness was brought out, and you contrast that to the fact that the Americans with Disabilities Act was brought to us by two women with serious mental illness. So there's obviously a lot of work to do there.
Any other questions for Nancy?
Jim? And did you, or suggest looking at the state statistical position?
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, when states have had to cut, there's been an interesting pattern sometimes, and you might recognize the illogical one, for example, of cutting home and community-based services rather than institutional services, having to do with how much the state can save by doing that, by given how much is paid by the Fed, rather than looking at, for the overall system, what would bring down the cost. So would bring down the cost of Medicaid. And so I just suggest using that measure, which Charlene certainly has in the past.
Well, actually, I do have per capita income in here. While that's been, I had a strong association, a lot of studies related to the provision of HCBS, I didn't see it affected here. There actually is another measure related to state taxing capacity. I worked with a student over this last year who looked at some other issues. It turns out, and we could never figure it out why, but the taxing capacity issue is correlated 0.8%. So, or 0.8, there's a 0.8 correlation between taxing capacity and nursing facility bed supply. We have no idea why, but that measure in analyses like this is, while it might be a better measure of kind of fiscal capacity, there are really issues related to kind of high correlations.
Susan Miller?
That's right, yeah, because we do not have, we're not using Medicare claims.
And the
right.
So it's likely that the Medicare costs increase a lot.
Absolutely. That, yeah, what we're picking up is just a very muted signal in both of those areas. So. That's a great question. We do have another way of looking at hospital utilization because we have an all-payer, aside from actually pulling down and linking in Medicare claims data, we've got an all-payer hospital data system in Arkansas that we're looking at using and linking that in to at least understand what's happening on the inpatient hospital admission side. I don't have anything I can tell you at this point from those analyses, but that is something we're looking into. The evaluation of the administration program was looking, I mean, you know, Medicaid was the major, our state Medicaid agency was the driver behind that that design. They were interested in a pure cost analysis to Medicaid, and so our endpoints were just Medicaid utilization and costs. We do have an interest in looking at a broader set of outcomes. We're looking at other opportunities for funding and actually some opportunities for some primary data collection so we can start to look at health-related outcomes and quality of life issues alongside that. We have some pretty compelling qualitative evidence, from the implementation evaluation side of the program that suggests there are some strong effects in that area as well.
In the back, yeah?
A large part of home and community-based services is personal assistance services, which could be self-directed. That means a family member can get paid to take care of the family member, which of course is cheap. You know, you're not paying what an agency would charge, you're paying $7.50 an hour. So my question to the panel, since you are working so closely with CMS, is there any future initiative to train the family member? Because they're getting paid to take care of that elderly, but they never receive any basic training, any formal training, and is this something that CMS will do for the future, that at least the family member who's getting paid gets some education?
Well, I can speak to that, not to say what CMS is or isn't doing, and people who know more about cash and counseling can correct me. But that was very much a concern. The cash and counseling demonstration, which we had in the began in the mid to late 19 1990s, which is and now is actually available to states after the demonstration. One of the real concerns there was that when one had cash and one could hire non-trained personnel, which in some cases could be family members, and in fact many people did hire family members, there were concerns that there would be poor quality of care. That that evaluation actually didn't find that there were those kinds of consequences. I know it continues to be a concern, but there wasn't evidence in that particular demonstration that that played out. But again, I'm not, I don't know kind of past that. I know that CMS is doing a lot of work related to quality issues in the community as part of their larger kind of rebalancing and things, but I'm not certain what they're doing in terms of training and things.
Just to add, in interviewing the home health care agencies, they're reporting because patients are coming out of the hospital quicker with less time, recovery time in the hospital, they're spending more time doing education and training with not just the patient but also the caregiver, which typically is a spouse or an elder child. And so the high performing agencies in particular are trying to spend equal amount of time. The new OASIS C instrument that we put out there has a specifically identified need for training in for caregivers across a number of different domains, including IADL and ADL care, as well as advocacy, transportation, and a whole bunch of other areas. So that we'll be able to collect some data on the need for training in home health, in situations where a patient is receiving home health and the caregiver is providing that support.
But I'm a geriatrician, and the problem with the home health is when you educate the caregiver and you educate the family, it's like a negative. You get punished because then the home health agency disappears. They can, instead of staying for 4 weeks, they can stay for 2 weeks because now they educated you.
Right.
So that's that.
It's not terribly long term, is it?
I have a question for Glenn in the ARC. You presented life expectancy of 66 and 69 years. Is that due to higher infant mortality in those counties, or is it due to, life expectancy? When we think about this, we think about at age 50. Is life expectancy at age 50 different generally, or is it, what's it seems a shortened life expectancy in those counties? That was kind of startling to me.
Yeah, that's a good question. And that reflecting on that first slide I showed with the graph, the implementation counties, the three counties of the original demonstration program for the Community Connector program has about a 10-year lower life expectancy than other regions of the state. And that is a combination of, there is a higher infant mortality rate in those states, but a lot of that gap is also attributable to premature mortality after age 50. There are, it is a rural population where there's a lot of aging in place happening, and there's there is a substantial portion of that gap in life expectancy is premature mortality at the at the later stages of lifespan.
I'd like the two workers from Arkansas to stand up and really take a hand of applause from us. Really, really, would you please stand up? Come on. Most often we get to just see the numbers crunchers. It's nice to see somebody who's doing the work out there. So thank you for coming. We appreciate it. I'm just additional measures. Morbidity, mortality measures. Is it that hard to? We did, Daniel and I, we had a demonstration, a small one, and we did the mortality for you can trace it back for a number of years. But you have a short time frame. It's hard to expect the mortality might differ between the treatment and control counties. I don't know. There are a lot of other issues involved in that matching too. So, well, I think what I'd like to do is ask everybody to resubmit for next year. We're going to be in Washington, and I think it'd be a great panel to follow up with it. And we may have an additional presenter. It's for me, it just a one-time glimpse of these things is not as important as seeing over time what happens. And most of these studies are going to be further along, and I think it'd be very interesting to see what's on later and just kind of benchmark what's happened to the next year too. So Any last questions? Yes, please. The vaccination part.
I think you said flu shots.
Was it?
Yeah, flu vaccination.
The seasonal flu shot, is that what you meant?
Or
were you talking about
pneumovax? I think it's just general flu vaccination. Yeah. Actually, it's available in this National Nursing Home Survey with both flu vaccination and pneumonia vaccination, but this for this study, we only included flu vaccination.
Is your question, which I had, and the Medicare population showed a lower proportion with the flu vaccination, is that due to the fact that it was a rehab population turned over more often, and the other, the Medicaid was more of a chronic and would have been in the nursing home? Correct. Right. Right. Correct, because it was more of a rehab, I would assume more of a rehabilitation and a shorter length of stay. Is that, Sunny, is that, would you want to comment on it? I'll give my own personal experience, having been in a nursing home in the last 4 months for a month. I never got a flu shot, but I never wanted one, so. Okay, Sunny, when you?
Actually, for the designing of the survey itself, it did not only collect data about onset flu vaccination, but also included the previous vaccination, prior to admission, but still within the certain time period. So it could be before the admission, but. Yes, that's the designing of the survey itself. But all the hospital admission and restraints are happening after the admission.
But I guess the point is that the fact that the Medicare population didn't have the same proportion with flu shots during the length of stay is not necessarily an indicator of poorer care, because they may have had a flu shot earlier or after, and it was a rehabilitation model as opposed to a more chronic long-term model. So. Well, I mean, these are very important questions, because without an interpretation, the data will lend to you to believe that Medicare patients didn't get the same quality of care as did others. But they're like, you know, the devil's in the details. Like most other data, there are other explanations. So, Michael?
One of the quality measures by CMS.
HRQ.
All right, well, either way, though, I mean, it does point out that being, even for a short stay, given our overall very low vaccination rates, getting people vaccinated, even if they're there for 90 days, would be in everybody's best interest while they're in the facility. Right? That's still what it's done, except for appearance.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I don't know if I would agree with that.
There could also be a difference in case mix, though.
Yes.
I mean, the person who's coming for rehab stay,
right,
which could be much less than 90 days.
Right.
Yeah, it would be a very different person.
Yeah, mine was 24 days. 24 days, and they asked me to take a cab from Worcester, Mass. to Rochester.
Well, I guess just to speak to
this just general point with the National Nursing Home Survey for anyone who's like got any kind of influence. I mean, the National Centers for Health Statistics sponsors all of these surveys, and with the 2004 survey, as Sunny mentioned, they no longer do a discharge survey. So all of us who are interested in these issues around kind of short-term versus long-term patients and all those things going on now, it can no longer be done with that survey. You have to move to the minimum data set. It's a current resident survey, and they expanded other surveys related to staffing issues and things that are very important, but you really can't tease out these very important issues around kind of patient types nearly as well.
I have another question, having recently been in a nursing home.
Yes.
You mentioned the PTs. But I was in Worcester, Jewish home in Worcester for less than 30 days. And I only saw a physical therapist on the evaluation, but I had PT with an assistant, PTA, every day I went there because for the therapy, and I had it like 40 minutes a day, 6 days a week. And then I saw the OT once, and maybe there was a reassessment later on, but then I had the OTA CODA. I know what those things mean, every 6 days a week too. So I don't know what that PT measure is, whether it's just a licensed physical therapist or all the assistants. But what's been happening with the cost pressures is they've been increasing the number of people, the physical therapy assistants. Now, giving an N of one, I thought they did a great job. Do you know what I mean? And because they came up and got me. And I didn't miss a session due to their issues, you see what I mean? I didn't miss a session, period. But so I don't know about, I mean, I think the number of physical therapist assistants has increased rapidly because they get, obviously they're paid less, I guess it depends about the type of rehabilitation you need. At my stage, I thought it was there was a lot of range of motion and a lot of movement, teaching me to get up on, crutches and stuff, so. I thought, I didn't notice the difference between a PT and a PTA. So, I mean, again, these measures, they're a lot to be sometimes desired because they're a little too global sometimes. So it would almost seem to me, just like in nursing, I don't know if it's the RN, in Massachusetts, the nurse is the LPN. In a hospital, it's an RN, but in a nursing home, it's an LPN. And these people came in and said, well, I'm your nurse. And I looked at them, I said, aren't you a licensed practical nurse? They said, no, I'm your nurse. And then someone said to me, you're from New York. That in Massachusetts, this is a nurse. In New York, you may have an RN, but in New York, that's because the daily cost is probably 50% more than it is in Massachusetts, and that was true. The daily cost in the Worcester Jewish nursing home was $350, and in Rochester, it's $550. So, and I thought I got great care at $350, but it happened, it was primarily LPNs, and PTAs and physical therapy assistants. So, I didn't see much difference. So, any other questions? Well, let's give a round of applause for our